Hey, welcome to In the Thick, a podcast about politics, race, and culture from a POC perspective. I'm Julio Ricardo Varela.
And I'm Jamila King.
And calling us from his office in Los Angeles, California, ITT All-Star, good friend, Jameel Smith, senior writer for Rolling Stone magazine. We got the band back together, Jameel. Welcome back.
What's going on?
All right, guys, let's just start with the latest. You know, it's what everyone's talking about. It feels all over the world. It's the latest on coronavirus, or also known as COVID-19, since Friday. And as of the recording this Tuesday morning, the cases in the United States have doubled to more than 700, with at least 26 deaths, mostly from the nursing home in Kirkland, Washington. This is across 36 states, including Washington, D.C., plus, another cruise ship docked in California on Monday with some infected passengers. It will unload passengers into quarantine, but not the crew. And around the world, there are more than 110,000 cases.
Right. And because of the epidemic, and after Saudi Arabia lowered oil prices, oil markets and stocks fell on Monday to the lowest they've been since 2008, causing the New York Stock Exchange to stop completely for 15 minutes. At this point, coronavirus is here, so we're in what's called mitigation, or basically social distancing. You've heard it. Self-quarantine if you've been exposed, wash your hands, all of that. To prevent any more community spread in the U.S., people are being encouraged to work from home. Some school districts have shut down, and some universities are teaching classes online. China's locked down entire cities to contain the outbreak. And on top of it all, the Trump administration has been giving conflicting information, who'd have thunk it, and is really calling into question the competency of our government in handling such a crisis while also exposing the faults of our healthcare system.
Right. And also, this was pretty dramatic. On Monday, Italy announced that it would lock down the entire country. We're talking 60 million people to try and contain the outbreak. And we want to discuss responsible reporting with context and facts. I mean, with a virus that's changing, it's new, and where we're still gathering the data, it's really hard to get concrete facts. So, for example, it's hard to determine the exact number of confirmed cases. Like we already know in the U.S., it's not easy to get tested. So probably there are more people infected in the country. So, Jamil, how do we report on this factually without creating hysteria?
We have to listen and report what the experts are saying. We have to listen to people who have training in the field. We have to talk to doctors. We have to, you know, speak to physicians, medical journalists, which there are such things. We have to let the facts do the talking and not our emotions. And, you know, frankly, we have to stop, you know, tweeting threads and retweeting people who are, you know, they're basically going off of speculation.
Yes.
You know, like, guys, we have to be responsible journalists. We have to understand what kind of platform that we have. And so I think that right now, I understand that everyone's emotional.
Right.
People have kids. People have families.
Right.
You know, we're all at risk. But we have to understand what role we have and really, you know, take it more responsibly than I think we have. I think, you know, there's people out here whose job it is to make sure that we have that information. Let's listen to them.
Yeah.
And I think one thing that's important that is being sort of highlighted in all the hysteria around this is that people do not trust the government, right? We have very legitimate reasons to question the federal government's response to this. I think any time over the past 4 years that the critique of the Trump administration has been that he is just uniquely unqualified to handle a disaster, this is exactly what folks were talking about. So I think that distrust is starting to show itself, right? I think that there is a lot of chaotic messaging. You've got the administration saying one thing. You've got Trump at his golf course saying another. You've got representatives going onto the floor of Congress with gas masks on, and then people in their districts dying, right? Like, it's a pretty chaotic time, and I think we're inundated with a lot of information. But I think it's important to just, like Jamil said, listen to the experts, right? Like, I think it's important to remember, too, that the CDC DC does represent the government, right? But it has a very specific mission in this instance. And, you know, I've been going onto the website, which is not something that I normally do, to get tips on sort of how to manage. And I'd encourage other folks to do the same.
You know, I think President Trump, to be honest with you, we should quarantine his comments. Can you imagine if we had the coverage that we're giving President Trump to actual experts, right? Let's hear what the experts are saying. That to me would change the entire conversation here, because it's pretty clear when you get these health experts who are understanding, who are studying this, who are really doing the work 24/7, not only the experts that are looking at the data, but people that are actually taking care of infected patients. There is context, there is facts, there's reality. President Trump right now is just going off on a tangent, and we're kind of chasing, we're the squirrels chasing the nut. And I think the journalist profession needs to just friggin' stop. Like, do not give President Trump this free airtime, because I do think that's part of the fucking problem.
Right.
One thing that really caught my eye, I don't know if you guys saw that, there was a tweet by immigration judges talking about the EOIR, which is the Executive Office of Immigration Review. It says EOIR has ordered immigration court staff to remove CDC posters designed to slow spread of coronavirus. No, this is not a parody account. I just find that to be reprehensibly sick.
Wow.
This is not the time to like turn this into an immigration debate. This is a time to like inform people in every language what the hell is going on and sharing CDC right. information.
We've seen time and time again that during these sorts of health outbreaks, it's our most vulnerable populations that are at risk. So you're seeing this in immigration facilities. You're seeing this in prisons. You're seeing, you know, I think there's a story out in New York State where, you know, Cuomo, the governor, has decided to have hand sanitizer that's being made inside of a prison, right? So it's, you know, this is nothing new. We know how it goes, right? But we just haven't changed.
You know, to that point, we have to recognize right now how the most, you know, marginalized communities and populations will be exploited, you know, every man and woman for themselves, essentially, right? And people are in a panic,
yeah.
are going to scramble for, you know, limited resources. And then
yeah.
we're going to see people resort to their basest instincts. And we've already seen it early on here in Los Angeles. You know, people, you know, starting to stereotype and discriminate against Asian Americans.
Yes.
And we're seeing top members of Congress, you know, calling it the Chinese coronavirus and the Wuhan coronavirus. And so we're already seeing this branding, this weaponizing
yes.
of this illness for, you know, essentially political, cultural gain, you know, for the Republican Party. They already see how they can use it without even worrying about saving lives. They're not strategizing for saving lives. They're strategizing how to keep their power.
Okay, so let's turn to another round of good news, the 2020 primary.
What a transition.
So today, Tuesday, is another big primary day with Idaho, Michigan, Mississippi, Missouri, North Dakota, and Washington State heading to the polls. So what we want to talk about is the power of voters of color, and particularly Black voters.
Right. And we're recording this early Tuesday morning, so we don't have any results, guys, to share yet. So if you're listening to this later this week, there's no results on this podcast. But Maria and I will update about the results during part of the Friday ITT sound off that we do.
Well, the trend since Biden's big Super Tuesday wins has been more moderates uniting. The latest to endorse Joe Biden are Kamala Harris.
And I've decided that I am, with great enthusiasm, going to endorse Joe Biden for president of the United States. I believe in Joe. I really believe in him, and I have known him for a long time. One of the things that we need right now is we need a leader who really does care about the people and who can therefore unify the people. And I believe Joe can do that.
And Cory Booker, on the other hand, Jesse Jackson and the Working Families Party endorse Sanders.
Right.
And as of this recording, Senator Elizabeth Warren has yet to endorse anyone. Jamil, for one of your latest with Rolling Stone, you wrote, in the immediate wake of someone suspending her or his campaign, both our elected officials and we in the press who cover them focus too acutely on the question of endorsements. It is an ugly, gossipy trend that distorts the very purpose of public service, placing more emphasis on what candidates can do for one another rather than what they can do for the voters. So what is the power of an endorsement? For Warren specifically, what's the power behind her lack of an endorsement compared to if she'd endorse Sanders or Biden?
It's wildly inflated. And I think it depends upon who you ask. I think, you know, if you ask one group of Sanders supporters, it seems like her endorsement means the world.
Yeah.
It means that she's lining up behind the one candidate left in the race who shares her ideals. And then to another group of Sanders supporters, you know, she is a tonko who doesn't mean anything, and we don't really need her. So I don't know exactly, you know, which do you need her or not?
exactly.
I'm not sure exactly how you build a coalition that wins an election when you not just convey mixed messages like that, but you actively sort of demand that people bend the knee rather than you court them to join you. That is a confusing strategy, to say the least. And it seems like it may not be coming from the campaign so much as, you know, the supporters online, but certainly the campaign itself has not made overtures outside of the senator himself in a very gracious statement immediately after she stepped out of the race.
You know, I've been in politics for a little while, and I have seen many, many campaigns, including campaigns that have spent a lot of money, kind of fade away. The message fades away the day after the candidate drops out or loses. That will not be the case with Senator Warren. She has run a very strong, issue-oriented campaign. And the reason that her campaign ideas will remain viable for many, many years is she has changed political consciousness in America, which at the end of the day is the most important thing that any candidate could do.
It seems like the campaign has not made overtures to her to have her come on board.
Yep.
And it seems like the Biden campaign has not done that either. It seems like they both have given her the time that she has requested.
Exactly.
In order to make up her mind or to do what she wants to do. Frankly, it seems to me like her greatest power to push her ideas, which have always seemed to be her priority, would be to not endorse and see how this plays out. And then to push her agenda, not just at the convention, but going forward in an administration should the Democrat win, and push her ideas forward as a senator, essentially as a leader in the Senate.
Yeah.
That to me seems like the most powerful position, rather than joining up with Sanders, because Sanders right now is not looking too good.
Yeah.
And then, say Biden becomes president, then you've endorsed his rival. And to me, that's a little bit of a weaker political position.
Yeah.
At the end of the day, if the ideas matter most, you have to play this in a smart way.
Welcome back to In the Thick. I'm Jamila King. With me is my co-host, Julio Ricardo Varela. And we're joined by ITT All-Star Jamil Smith. Let's get back to the conversation.
You know, it's starting to feel like 2016 right now. And obviously, we'll know more after the Tuesday results. One thing that's happening again, which I think it's just becoming a brand, this whole like Bernie bro narrative sweeping the media, right, and Twitterverse, right? And we have to point out that whatever you talk about the Sanders campaign, you know, the Sanders support is still diverse. I mean,
yeah, they should not be branded by their most abusive supporters online. That's completely unfair.
Right. So, for example, one of the things that I think we can all agree is that Latino voters are keeping Sanders in the game. You know, in Texas, Sanders won almost all the border areas, despite Biden taking the state. And also he won the border area in California. That's all predominantly Latino. So in today's election results, I'm going to be specifically looking at Latino districts in Washington State. The Tri-Cities area is over 20% eligible Latino voters. Also in Southwest Detroit, where we just did a live show, that is significantly Latino. And even parts of Idaho. And also if you look at Western Michigan, and I'm going to add another factoid. According to a recent study in exit polling data from the Council of American Islamic Relations, for Super Tuesday, Muslim Americans voted overwhelmingly for Sanders. 58.2 for Sanders, followed by Biden at 26.8. We know that a state like Michigan has a very significant Muslim American voting population. You even have, you know, you have Rashida Tlaib, who's on the squad, who is a Sanders supporter. Are voters of color being oversimplified or overlooked in this season, right, in this primary season, particularly in terms of Sanders supporters? And how much are we falling into the trap of 2016 with overstating how influential Twitter politics are?
I think, one, you know, we started this election year talking about how this, you know, was the most diverse field of presidential contenders that we'd ever had in a primary. And obviously that's not the case now. But I think one part of this conversation that we're missing around representation is that representation isn't just by itself the goal, right? Representation is just one part of building political power.
Right.
And, you know, we've seen time and time again that, you know, all skin folk ain't kin folk, right? So I think that we forget that we're also talking not just about the people we're electing to represent us, but their policies. We're talking about, you know, what they bring to the table, which communities they're advocating for. And so, you know, here we are again with two white men leading the Democratic primary. But I think, you know, they've taken very different sort of approaches, obviously, in their political ideology. But, you know, my colleague at Mother Jones, Fernanda Echavarri, wrote about how Bernie had built up this huge network in the Coachella Valley in an effort to really target Latino voters in California. Right. So I think we just have to keep in mind that at the end of the day, voters of color are the backbone of this democracy, in part because we're so numerous. But, you know, it's not just about how diverse the field of representatives is, although that's very important. It's about what they do to reach out to folks of color.
Jamil, what do you think?
Well, I mean, I think it's important that, you know, these candidates don't take votes of marginalized communities for granted. Yes, you know, at this point in American politics, the Democratic Party is the only place that these communities can turn to. That being said, they have to still earn their votes. And as Jamil was saying, you have to present policy plans for what you are going to do as president. You can't simply say, yes, I'm the best person to beat Trump, and this is maybe even my plan to do it. Okay, well, you still have to be president 4 years after that. What are you going to do for those 4 years?
Yeah.
You know, there's still a lot of baggage and, frankly, troubling things about both men that are remaining in this race, you know, that we have to interrogate for both Black and Latino and Latina voters.
Exactly.
I think we have to, you know, talk to these men about things that they've done in their past, things that they've said, and things that are in their policy platforms that we have to interrogate and improve.
Just one last thing on the Twitter bit. You know, I think that we talk a lot about the influence of social media on elections. It began in 2008 with Obama and Facebook. We can't discredit Twitter, right? As much as we want to say these are just some loud mouths on Twitter, even if you agree that it's just a segment of the population on Twitter, like, these are pretty prominent surrogates and folks who are being attacked, right? So I think it does matter. I think you've seen and heard the same things from a number of candidates. You've heard it from Kamala Harris. You've heard it from Hillary Clinton. You've heard it from Elizabeth Warren now, right? That the sort of toxicity of Bernie bros, even if it's, you know, just a few bad actors, it's meaningful, right? Because it touches on something that we're not dealing with, whether it's the platforms themselves not doing enough to, you know, do anything about harassment, or the candidate, you know, not doing enough to sort of rein in his supporters.
Yeah.
So today will be a crucial day for Sanders, a make or break moment. And Michigan will be key as the state with the most delegates to win today. Reminder that Sanders did win this state in the 2016 primary. But as of Monday, the Detroit Free Press did a poll showing that Biden has a 24-point lead over Bernie Sanders.
Right. And ITT All-Star Terrell J. Starr, who we actually got to hang out with last week when we were in Detroit, he stayed in Detroit and covered the Michigan primary for The Root. And I want to share just one quote that Terrell wrote. This is what he says. There are a few towns in America in which you can gauge Black enthusiasm for the political process better than the Motor City, as one of the Blackest cities in the country. And Terrell added this quote, Sanders does lead Biden with younger voters 18 to 34 who make up 21% of Tuesday's electorate. Sanders relies heavily on young voters of color to make up for the dearth of Black voters over 35 who tend to lean toward centrist candidates. But this is 2020, and many people here are worried that a candidate like Sanders is too risky to go up against Trump in the fall.
We also know that Michigan is unpredictable.
Yeah.
Washington State has the second most delegates to win today, and Sanders also won this state in the 2016 primary. However, this year, the state is doing its primary voting entirely by mail, which honestly may be a good thing for turnout given the intensity of the coronavirus there. So with these six states voting today, Julio and Jamil, what can we expect to see with young voters and voters of color? Jamil, I'll start with you.
I mean, if I'm Sanders, I first hope that they show up.
Yeah.
Because
you need
number
them.
One, if you are hoping to win and you are basing your hopes for the White House on young voters, thus far, he has not shown the ability to bring them out in the numbers that he needs to in order to create a winning coalition. Thus far, they have not come to the polls in the kinds of numbers that he needs in order for him to overtake, the sort of more moderate, traditional voting base of the Democratic Party. If you're going to create, and I'm not, mocking the term here, but if you're going to actually create a revolution within the party, you have to show up. You have to actually do it.
Yes.
You can't just adopt the values
right.
And proclaim and signify out loud, whether it's on social media or at rallies or what have you, and then not show up to vote. So unless he actually can get the numbers, then he's going to lose. But right now, it looks like there's a possibility he could get swept in all of the states tonight. In Washington, it looks like he has a slim lead in the polls, but, that is no longer a caucus. And Jesse Jackson's endorsement may help to a certain degree, but I mean, that's somebody that my generation,
yes.
barely remembers, let alone people in, who are millennials and Gen Zers. So it's going to actually take the kind of work that the Sanders campaign, frankly, has not engaged in sufficiently, I think, to bring out Black voters and to engage with older, more moderate Black voters to reassure them that he is a safer choice.
Yes.
That he is the guy who can beat Trump head on, and that, hey, I have a platform that, yes, is further left than Joe Biden, but I am a safer choice. Instead, he's just stuck with his same 2016 platform, the same 2016 approach, more or less, with a few more mentions of racism and mention of intersectionality, I guess you could say.
Mm.
But it's honestly, he hasn't made enough halftime adjustments, as one might say in the sports world.
I love it.
And frankly, I think it's costing him.
Yeah.
And what I would hate to see is for him and his campaign and his followers to start blaming other people.
Yes.
For what, at the end of the day, is his fault.
Black voters are voting. Do not be dismissive of the Southern Black vote that has been coming out saying we're picking a candidate to beat Trump. And the other thing about Sanders, he has tapped in with young Latinos from a progressive standpoint, but I also think that the numbers of young Latinos, it's a young, growing electorate. You're seeing the future of the Democratic Party, but not the reality right now. So I think that's really important.
All right, guys, this has been a heavy show. So let's do something a little bit more lighthearted. Let's move on to our final segment, Binge Worthy. What are you binging on?
Right. What's something you've watched, read, listened to that you can't stop thinking about? Doesn't have to be journalism. Could be anything, Jamil. You're on the West Coast. Come on, bring it.
All right. One is a book by my friend Charlotte Alter, The Ones We've Been Waiting For. It's just out, and it is phenomenal. And it's all about essentially millennials who actually, you know, still believe in public service.
Nice.
People, yes, like Pete Buttigieg and a lot more, you know, less famous people. People like Michael Tubbs, you know, mayor of Stockton, California, and, you know, even some, yes, Republicans. And it's really, really an encouraging read that, you know, gave even, you know, my cynical behind some hope in what may come after, you know, this older generation is gone, and you know, seeing what may lay ahead in terms of American leadership. And so that's one thing. But also just in terms of just sort of like tuning out, there's a great new series that I've started watching recently called Dev on FX on Hulu.
The last time I saw him, he was headed toward Devs, and then he disappears. Something bad happened to him.
You know what happened to him. If you came for answers, ask me what you don't know.
What is Devs?
It's Alex Garland, who did Ex Machina and Annihilation. And I just really enjoy intelligent sci-fi, and it is really, really, really good so far. So I would encourage people to check that out.
Nice. Real quick, I'll just say mine is the Hillary documentary. It's a docuseries on Hulu.
I provoked strong opinions.
Are we ready?
There's so much to talk about.
Okay. I didn't grow up thinking about going into politics, but much to my surprise, was elected president of the Young Republicans.
No matter how you feel about Hillary, I think it's important. I think that it places her within really important historical context to give some. And she's more candid there than she's ever been. I think that's important. So watch that. It's fun.
Okay. I wish that would have been more of 2016. Okay. Mine is really quick and it has nothing to do with the magazine that Jamil works for. But ever since I saw Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, the Rolling Stones' Out of Time has been playing in my head, and I got back to early Rolling Stones.
Baby, 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 you're out of time.
Damn, what the? Why didn't I stop listening to early Rolling Stones? I'm telling you, the Rolling Stones in the 60s? Jesus, what a band. So anyway, I'm all over the Rolling Stones again. All right, ITT All-Star Jamil Smith, senior writer for Rolling Stone magazine. Thank you so much for joining Jamila and me on In the Thick.
My pleasure.
I'm Julio Regalo Varela.
And I'm Jamila King.
Uno, dos, tres.
Hey, guys, remember, go to Apple Podcasts to rate and review us because it really, really helps. You can also listen to In the Thick on Pandora, Spotify, and wherever you get your podcasts. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at In the Thick Show. Like us on the Facebook and tell your friends. Hey, you can also listen to Jamila King on the Mother Jones podcast every Wednesday. In the Thick is produced by Nicole Rothwell and Noor Saudi. Our audio engineers are Stephanie LeBeau, Julia Caruso, and Leah Shaw. And our digital editor is the fabulous Luis Luna. And our intern is the other fabulous Carla Arroyo. The music you heard is courtesy of Nacional, Kept, and ZZK Records. We'll see you next time. Thank you so much for listening. Nos vemos.
Stay safe out there, y'all. It is, 9:10, 6:10 Jamil's time. let's all just to hold that for
it's a
minute.
Fucking rock star, man.
Pour one out for me.
The opinions expressed by the guests and contributors in this podcast are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of Futuro Media or its employees.